Well, good morning to everyone. Certainly a blessing to see you all with us today. typically, our brother Lee teaches this class, but he said his voice was less than reliable this morning. And so he's asked me to fill in. We're going in a different vein than is usual, which is an overview of the Old Testament. This morning, we're going to be talking about Christian evidences, and we're going to take little sideward trip from that that can lead to some discussion and some insights and thoughts that perhaps we haven't entertained before. Before we get started, I wonder if I might ask Larry to lead us in a word of prayer. Thank you.
Lord God, Father in heaven, how grateful are we to be here this day, realizing that the blessings that we have are not enjoyed by great majority of the world. We have come to this place in air conditioning and heated comfort at 50 miles an hour. We come here again to be sheltered. We come then to be free to study your word, to learn the depths of your wisdom. And then we are free, brethren, to to learn and thereby to grow. We pray, Lord God, our Father, as you look upon us this morning, be well pleased with your children. You will see a family.
Especially in this day and time, we find ourselves confronting secular explanations for every aspect of our lives, from where we came from to where we're going and to how we should be living in the time in between. Very few pay attention to the statement by the psalmist, who in Psalm 19 said, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge." This was not so much the case even 40 or 50 years ago, when people had more of a spiritual focus in some respects than perhaps we do in society today. And it certainly was not the case back in the early 1800s when a man by the name of William Paley wrote a book called Natural Theology. And I'm not going to quote directly from it. I'm going to basically take some thoughts from the arguments that he presents in that book. And this book is called Natural Theology, or Evidences of the Existence and Attributes of the Deity, collected from the appearances of nature. And it was in answer to some of the arguments that William Paley made that another individual that we hear about today, much more so, the author of The Origin of the Species, had answer to some of the arguments which he makes. The interesting thing is that, of course, evolution remains as the mainstay of society's explanation for our existence, whereas it has not really been examined or appreciably changed in, what, over 150 years. And this individual's arguments really can only be expanded upon because of their validity and the truth which they represent. So, as I said, I'm just going to be taking some overarching thoughts from this, not necessarily and directly quoting it. If you should happen to have opportunity to read it, certainly you might find it a little bit challenging, since the vernacular of 1802 is a little different than what we would speak today. But if you can extract his line of thought, I think you would perhaps be blessed. So let's notice here, this simple question. And this is how William Paley begins his book. Something as simple as this. You walk outside. You stub your toe as you're walking down a path on a rock. And the presumption is that rock has always been there. We don't really ponder too much where it came from. We just presume that it's always been there. But then you come across a watch. What if you found a watch lying on the ground? Would you suppose it's always been there? Why not? What would lead you to a different conclusion, perhaps, than the one you might have with the rock? Let me entertain any observations. Anybody other than Bill Spahn? The watch has design. Okay? And that's what we're going to be talking about throughout the lesson this morning, is design. And that fact implies something else that we must reach as a conclusion, or we should reach as a conclusion, if we imply design into that watch. What is that inference that we make of necessity? Yes.
There's a maker.
There's a maker. There's a designer. And so that's what we see from this simple illustration, and it's one that has been attacked by an illustration that's been attacked by everyone pretty much in the evolutionary camp. And this is the origin of it. That simple illustration has provoked a great deal of response amongst scientists even today, the watchmaker analogy. One of the things that we can observe from this particular analogy, for example, as you look at that watch, what further inferences can you deduce? Asking us to put on our thinking caps today, Bill.
Well, if you found this there sitting and it was running.
Okay.
You know that it hadn't been running forever.
Okay.
It was a spring watch. But if it was a battery watch, the same thing would be
true.
True. And that's just one thing.
Okay. But
so you have to get it started.
Short of what you just said, which is true, you noticed it was running, which means it was functional. That we can observe that this collection of gears and this encasement, and then if you turned it over and saw the face of it, we can infer a function from it.
When you notice, you tell time, you notice there was a purpose.
Okay. And you would also be able to infer that the designer of it, you know, had a concept of time that we have and so on, so that you could utilize it in that way. So, and there's even so much more that we could observe from this, but we'll just start out with those. Bill, in the back there.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, it's intelligently designed.
Yeah. And when we talk about intelligence, of course, we're talking from an anthropomorphic viewpoint. In other words, from a human viewpoint, it's intelligent. And so, you know, we have also assumed that, you know, that things that appear intelligent to us as human beings must come from one who is, finish that sentence, intelligent. Okay, so at least of equal intelligence, right? And if I had the skill of being a watchmaker and knew how to make a watch, then I could say, here, this fellow is of equal intelligence. But if I'm looking at it and going, how does this conglomeration of gears function and what's the principles involved here, then I'm getting to the point where I'm concluding that this intelligence is what? Above mine. At least in that respect. And that's all we can say. Okay, so we can see how we can take things like this and we can present some arguments and observations that to an individual who's being rational and reasonable, which are seems like you're getting harder and harder to find nowadays, but someone who's being rational and reasonable, we can make some rather strong arguments. And we can also strengthen one another's faith by presenting these reasonable explanations for us to have faith. Another point which the author Paley made in his book on natural theology was a comparison of the eye and the telescope. We've heard these illustrations before, but maybe we didn't know precisely where these illustrations originated, and I think many of them originated in his book. This idea of the eye and the telescope. Now, why do we put these things in the same sentence here? But well, when one compares the human eye with a telescope, how can we conclude that it doesn't show evidence of an intelligent design which necessitates an intelligent designer? If you want to read some fascinating material, look up the function and the features of the human eye. And then look up in general just eyes, plural, throughout nature. And in different places and different species and different regions and so on, the eye functions in totally different ways. There was an argument being made that the human eye was designed backwards because the image actually reflects off of the retina in the back of the eye and goes to the cornea in the front and then is transmitted through the optic nerve. But it was pointed out that when researchers looked at this, they saw that the rods and cones, which are what receive the light impulses, were facing the opposite way. They wouldn't be nearly as effective, and they would tend people would go blind, much more likely. And so the way that God has, I believe God has designed it, I'll try not to say that, except I can't help it. The way that it has been designed has shown that this designer is incredibly knowledgeable, and not just of how to design something to accomplish a function, but how to design it to last and to function over a period of time. The telescope, of course, from light that comes in the front, it's refracted by a lens, an objective lens they call it, to a focal point within the telescope body or tube, and then it is perceived by the eyepiece in the back, which is another lens that brings it into focus for the human eye. And the human eye, we see things upside down and backwards, but our brain inverts and right sides up for our, so that we can get around without bumping into things and seeing things or acting out of coordination with the things around us. I was amazed as well when I consider that, we don't just have one eye in the realm of creation, that every baby that's born has two of them. And in the greatest number, those are perfectly functional and will remain so throughout that individual's life. Any comments or observations? Not meaning a pun there when I say observations, but because this class is yours as well, and anybody that has any thoughts on it certainly can do that. Paley also brought out that the fact that life comes either from an egg or from a seed is a truly remarkable thing. It's not just that these living things are in existence and they come into existence, but through this process of miniaturization of all of the necessary components, then through the process of growth, they become what they're intended to be. You know, when you look at an egg and you consider that from that collection of fluid and the substance that's in there, any one of a number of different birds or reptiles can come out. And of course, ultimately, even human beings and animals have in some form or another an egg, although it doesn't necessarily have a hard shell like the ones we're showing in the picture. Miniaturization requires a very highly developed intelligence, and the natural world shows us how life begins with very small things, seeds and eggs. Now, if you were asked to undertake designing something, and you designed something as massive as a tree, and you had all of the physics worked out so that the tree supported itself and had all of the necessary capacities to function that a tree does. And then you were told to take all of that and then to reduce it down to the point that you could put it in something the size of perhaps your fingernail. Would that require some degree of intelligence? I think so. Yeah.
Is built by this process. But we never could figure out how to, once we got it built, that it would reproduce itself.
Yes.
I mean, that would be pretty neat. That you could drop a seed off the side.
Yeah.
Another one would grow up. So, I mean, the point you're making is excellent to see the that not only do we have this wonderful complex tree or plant or whatever, but we have equally as amazing, if not even more amazing, how that it continues to reproduce and repopulate. And I mean, in construction, that's not even, you're not even scratched. In my field, we didn't even try to do anything like that.
No.
Because it would have been so complex and intricate that you couldn't.
Yeah.
So, anyway, just the difference of how we build things and how God does.
Yeah. And if you probably started talking like that, they'd call up an institution called Washington State, Western Washington State, and they'd say, we have a candidate for one of your rooms there. Because it's just unheard of. But within all living things is something that's even more remarkable, and that is within every seed, every egg, every living creature, every species of living thing has a miniaturized code which enables it to reproduce its own kind and to do so in abundant supply. So this is you know, where what Bill was talking about would have to get started. The builders would have to devise some kind of a code that they could put into such a tiny, tiny thing that it would be transmittable to all of these different living things, and then interpreted and then acted upon, you know, in more or less an automatic fashion. And yet, to even make it more remarkable and astounding, that in the DNA of anything, there's basically only five basic components that are mixed in and blended and, you know, adjusted, and then there's a key that attaches to it called RNA. And all of those things work together to transmit instructions to cells so that they can form what is to be in existence. Now, what I'm talking about right now, William Paley didn't talk about, because in 1802 they didn't know about DNA. But you see, today we have the advantage of scientific facts, not theories, but facts. Scientific theories lean against in opposition to faith. But if we look at scientific facts, they point us more and more and more toward a belief in an intelligent designer. And that intelligent designer, in this case, is so incredibly intelligent that it wasn't until just a few years ago that we as human beings understood this whole idea that we're talking about of DNA. And of course, great things have been done with the DNA and so on, and that's a whole other subject. But this is just to point us in a general way towards faith and how we can turn the conversation toward belief in God. Yes.
Just to point too, that even though we're not studying the Bible, which is one form of God's
right
revelation, we are studying another form of God.
Yes.
Because it's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Last class, Romans 1, that He revealed Himself through all this amazing creation. Yes. When you look down at this level, it just gets even more amazing. That it just shouts out.
Yeah.
Information comes from somebody who comes from a mind, right?
Exactly. And just to remind everyone of what Bill was speaking about, in Romans 1, in verses 19 through roughly 21, and it goes on even further, but Paul makes this argument. He says, let's begin at verse 18, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them, for His invisible attributes, namely His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made so they are without excuse." They are without excuse. That's not me saying that. That's the Holy Spirit through Paul saying that people who reject the evidence in creation and say there is no God, they might pretend to be intellectually honest, but the Scripture says they're without excuse. They have more than enough reason to reach the conclusion that faith in God is appropriate. Any other comments? Okay. One of the things that Paley argued was from the bones and the muscles in our body. And I was thinking of this particular illustration. Here's an image of what to some might look like a tangle of ropes and pulleys. But you just take a moment and look at it, you see that they are designed to raise and lower the sails on a ship and to move timbers on a sailing ship. And they're designed very specifically. They're engineered, for the application that they're being used on. And they function by very intelligent manipulation on the part of the ship's crew. And then we turn and we look at the human body and see how our bodies evidence natural engineering with bones that are strong enough to support our bodies, with ball and joint sockets, tendons and ligaments and muscles of sufficient size to make movement efficient and powerful. We not only can we move, but we can do some pretty remarkable things as human beings. And of course, if you look at nature and see in the insect world, they can do sometimes 100 times more than what we're capable of in terms of strength and the capacity that they have. And they have a whole different structural system for their bodies that's sufficient for what they're doing. So again, something seems to point to an intelligent designer. Not only do we have, you know, physical structures in our body, but we have chemical machines in our body. You know, look at the oil and chemical refinery. You know, you might see one as you go down the freeway somewhere, say in Tacoma, and look at that and you go, you know, this is designed to perform carefully controlled chemical processes, isn't it? It's not just a collection of random pipes that all ended up in one place. And it's necessary to produce fuels and lubricants and all other kinds of chemicals that we use in the world today. But consider the human digestive system. And again, in nature, animals and people have digestive systems which control the organism's metabolism by processing food into nutrients and other substances through carefully regulated chemical processes involving powerful acids and complex chemicals. The acids produced by your stomach are amongst the most powerful known to man. And yet, they're regulated carefully so that they are powerful enough to digest the food and not digest your system, which they, in cases of pancreatitis, that is somewhat happens, that they literally digest portions of the stomach. Yeah.
I think the key word here too is system.
System, exactly.
Just one thing, but like the oil refinery over there, I have no idea what those different power parts for.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm pretty sure, if I know something about any kind of mechanical factory, that one of those parts really isn't going to do a whole lot of that without that other part also being there.
Mm-hmm.
The one on the end is the one that really takes care of whatever process it takes care of.
Right. Right.
And over here, too, we have something very similar. There's not only just one thing, but there's a system that has come together. And the only way you can do that on the left is if you've got somebody who knows a lot more than I do about oil refinery.
Yeah.
Coming up with this plan and then executing it and building it. So same thing with our bodies.
Yeah.
That it's not just, you know, one thing that came about by chance. It's this complex, interrelated system.
Right.
That could fall.
And not only is it designed by intelligence, but, you know, we would hope and pray that it's operated by intelligence, that they don't accept people who otherwise might apply to McDonald's or something. You know, nothing against McDonald's. I'm a partaker. But, you know, the level of knowledge and skill is going to be somewhat greater than an entry-level worker. It's going to be somebody who has the knowledge of these processes and how they can even go wrong. So all of that's important. The process of photosynthesis, which goes on all around us and across the globe, to me is absolutely phenomenal. We talk about solar power. And, you know, that's where we have, of course, panels that collect sun rays and turn that into electrical power. And that's relatively complex, but really infinitely more complex is this process of photosynthesis. That what you and I perceive as sunlight, you know, and we get warm by it or we get, you know, too hot, whatever, and take off a coat or put on a layer because it's not warm enough, actually produces a material effect in the world around us that plants actually derive nutrients from light. I work in the lighting industry, and I don't deal very much with grow lights, but grow lights are not only evaluated by their color temperature and their, you know, intensity, But they're also evaluated by those who are in the, you know, hydroponic industry with respect to the nutrients that are derived from these lights. So that the plants actually derive their food from the light. And in the process of collecting that energy through the leaves, in the cells themselves of the leaf, they, you know, build up this food that, that the plant needs and ultimately causes it to grow. And again, we have an infinite number of forms of plants that, that use this process. And, of course, they also do so in a very beautiful and elegant fashion in that many of these plants produce flowers that just astound us with their beauty. And that's another argument that, that could be made, which I don't know why I didn't think of it at this particular point, is that one of the attributes that, that we see in creation is something above and beyond what evolution would demand, which is, you know, that we have everything that's necessary for the survival of the fittest. But who in society really needs the, or who in the creation really needs the beauty of an orchid? What purpose does that serve? And, you know, so we see things above and beyond what's absolutely necessary for survival, and we have to ask ourselves why. Could it be that the designer and creator of these things has a sense of beauty as well that he has shown us through the creation? And, of course, that doesn't prove anything, but it does, in my mind, tell me something about the God whom I worship. Okay. Now, when it comes to the human body, or when it comes to actually not just the human body, but animals in particular, animals possess a brain which is highly complex and which perform many functions both conscious and subconsciously to regulate bodily functions on multiple levels at once. Complex solid-state circuitry is clearly a result of intelligent design. How much more the brain which conceived it? Yeah. This is one area where I do not understand how anyone who comprehends, you know, this science walks away without believing in God. In fact, one of the leading physicians, neuroscientists in the country, this individual by Varun, I can't pronounce his name. I couldn't pronounce his name when he performed surgery on my wife. He's right up here in Kirkland. He's listed among the leading physicians of the world on Facebook, for what that's worth. He's a brain surgeon. You don't have to be a brain surgeon to believe in God, but this man is one, and he does believe in the Creator. In fact, he I'm not sure what exact religious faith he's part of in terms of any denominational association, but he is listed as an elder of some of a particular church on Mercer Island. And so when people throw this back in your face and say, well, you know, this is just superstition and this is just, you know, for you to believe in God and all this, look at neuroscience, look at all these different frontiers of science, we can always turn back and say, you know, there are people who know that science who believe firmly in God. In fact, one of the quotes that this doctor has made on a radio program he was on, he said, I don't see how anyone could, who's had their hands in the human brain cannot believe that God created it at all. Pretty impressive from someone who's had his hands in the human brain. And, of course, the complexity of the human brain, as we were talking here just a moment ago, is just beyond comprehension. Of course, we're using our brains to try to comprehend our brains. So, I mean, you know, we'll see how far we go with that. But there's a whole network of connections that store our memories and make them accessible to us. And we have those in each one of us. All right. Birds and fish. Again, Paley makes this argument that we see God in nature, in that birds and fish have these features that serve them in their environment. We have birds that all have wings so that they can reside, you know, without, you know, they can fly through the atmosphere. And fish who have fins so that they can function in the water. And not only that, but there's systems built into birds and systems built into fish that provide for these functions. For example, fish have what's called a float bladder that, you know, precisely balanced so that, you know, they're swimming upright. And you know as well as I do that if you have an aquarium and you have a fish that's decided to swim upside down, that's not a good sign. So, just again, an argument to notice. Also, Paley noticed what I have coined as compensatory capacities of different creatures. Consider how there are so many examples of compensation in the design of animal types. Just two examples that I draw out here. The spider who has no wings to fly after prey has the compensatory capacity to make a natural net or web to catch a prey. Now, there's several things that you would need to consider here. First of all, how did the spider, when it was first generated, know that it would want to prey upon flying insects? That was built into it, wasn't it? It was given a target assignment when it was first hatched. And then, who came up with, or how did it come up with this answer that I'm going to generate my own net, and I'm going to design it and build it wherever I need it so that I can catch these flying insects? And not just, you know, a little tiny thing, but it generates these huge, huge webs, as you well know when you walk out your front door and they've been busy at work right there in your face. So, then look at the elephant. The elephant has almost no neck because of the bulk of its head. I mean, it wouldn't be able to support its head if it had much of a neck, you know, protruding from its body. But instead, it has an elongated nose so that it doesn't have to bend its head or neck. It doesn't have to, you know, reach up by bending its neck to get things out of trees or reach down by bending its neck to draw up water or whatever. And we can see this all around us in oh so many different forms. But again, it shows us that there was, and this is what I hope you get a sense of also, that when these animals and plants were first made, they were made with an overall purpose and objective in mind. All the parts worked together. You know, it didn't just somehow evolve an eyeball or somehow evolve a long nose. It had all of these things already together in order for it to survive. How would an elephant without a trunk ever have survived? It couldn't get down to get water or get up to get food. It wouldn't have survived. How could birds that they claim evolved wings over time have survived all those years running under the bushes without wings to fly and get away? What did they do? Get together out in a circle somewhere and say, oh, wish we could fly, wish we could fly, wish we could fly. They have that Peter Pan experience. No, of course not. Otherwise, they wouldn't have survived. Now, this next point that I make is something we're going to kind of move quickly through because it involves a whole range of things. But another thing that we observe from a principle that Paley brought out in his book is that in nature, the sum is greater than its parts. And we see this through the cycles that are present in the earth today, natural science. Take, for example, the carbon cycle. All of this is going on about, you know, our carbon footprint. And, you know, it really, you know, is a state of panic and fear-mongering that they're doing to younger people and to those who have enlisted in their faith in pseudoscience to think that this is all going to lead to the destruction of the world in 12 years. Here's how this cycle works. If we look at, you know, take it from the ground up, for example. There's deep ocean sediments. There's rock that's in the earth. There's sedimentary rocks, coal, oil, and gas, which are presently burned for fuel in a great part of the world. But sedimentary rocks are also weatherizing and eroding, which means that they're releasing carbon. Soil and organic carbon is being generated. There is decomposition by both plants and animals, which again releases carbon. There's burning in the world, forest fires, any kind of burning for that matter, that releases carbon all up into the atmosphere. There are plants plant respiration rather, which releases CO2 into the atmosphere. And all of this being released into the atmosphere then comes back in the form of photosynthesis, respiration on the part of living things, diffusion throughout the atmosphere, and even throughout the deep ocean currents. Carbon is being recycled. That's the state of this cycle. And, of course, even as they pointed out, erupting volcanoes bringing up material from the depth of the earth. And I realize this is just a quick overview, but all of these things work together so that we have a place in which we can live. And if any of these things were altered appreciably in their original makeup, we could never have existed here because we're carbon-based beings. And so, again, something or someone was modulating this whole process to enable us to exist. Same thing is true with water. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, this is obviously not brief models, right?
Right. I'm going to go through these next two real quickly. I don't want to labor the point. You see that true with respect to the cycle of water, precipitation leading to evaporation into a condensation, transportation through trees back into the atmosphere of water. Again, you know, that cycle just being carried on throughout the whole ecosystem in which we live. And it's carefully regulated. So that's an amazing thing. And then also with regards to nitrogen. And I'm not a chemist, so I'm not able to go into this to a great deal, but nitrogen, which is essential to life, also is through cycles in our environment. So what this all gets to is this argument of fine-tuning. Now, if I set you down behind this particular control panel, and I told you, now, for there to be, for this to function, you need to get everything to within a hair's breadth. If you're off on any of these, it's not going to work. And, if any of these dials are not set perfectly right, we're not going to have anything. That's how our creation is, there is a sense in which everything around us has been provided for us to exist within, a hair's breadth of fine-tuning, just so that it's perfect for us. Anything more, anything less would have thrown everything off, and it wouldn't be possible. The fine-tuning of the universe is due to either physical necessity, chance, or design. It's not physically necessary in terms of base material things that the universe be fine-tuned as it is, or that this planet be fine-tuned as it is. And it's not due to physical necessity or to chance. It's beyond the realm of chance possibility. We have people who believe they can answer all their problems by, six little balls popping up with the right number on them. And I admit, I fantasize about it. Sure. Who wouldn't fantasize about having, $100 million? But if you take that scenario of these balls popping up, having the right number on them, and in order for us to have something comparable to the winning super lottery for creation, you would have an infinite regression of balls popping up with exactly the right number on them, and you'd need to be holding the winning ticket in order to exist. And that's something, of course, which any one of us should recognize is just not an adequate answer. We have our galaxy. Yes. I wasn't going to get into that. Right.
What you're saying here is that things are so particularly balanced, all these fine things, a number of things that you haven't had time to go into, that it's really, really, and evolutionary scientists are seeing the same thing that you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And so they realize that in a universe like ours, there just simply isn't enough time.
Yeah.
And over here, and the life exists. And so what they come up with, and it's just amazing, and everybody's heard of it, is, well, then there's probably an infinite number of universes that we don't know anything about.
Mm-hmm.
And even though we lost one, we got it right. Of course, it just happened by accident. And so when you think of, I'm just saying that, talking about this, the extremes that people go to.
Oh, yeah. Right. And yet the individuals who bring this up claim that they are the science-based people that are in the discussion here, and yet they're willing to resort to their own fantasies and offer them as being more plausible than, to me, a very credible and plausible explanation that God created it all. Quickly here, and of course we recognize that we exist in the Milky Way galaxy, which astronomers have pointed out is a configuration that allows for us to be in the right spot, to be formed into a planet that could sustain life. And our solar system, and that in that solar system, we happen to have sat down in the right chair. You know, we're not too close to the heater, not too far from the heater. We're just in the right chair. That's where that Goldilocks idea came from, and in terms of not too hot, not too cold. And of course, the Earth itself, being not just, you know, the right position from the sun, but being an iron core planet, wherein the core of the planet rotates in an opposite direction of the exterior of the planet. And that generates something that's truly remarkable called a magnetic field around the Earth, which helps to deflect the sun's harmful rays and also protect us from projectiles coming through the atmosphere and so on to some degree. And there's so much more to that that we could spend a great deal of time. I see that our time really has expired here. I appreciate your attention, and I hope that I haven't been someone who's talked over your heads, but just to present the things in a concise and kind of effective way so that you can see we do have a great deal with which we can arm ourselves to defend our faith and show it to be reasonable indeed. Any comments as we're closing? Karen? Absolutely.
And God is always there throughout everything.
Yeah.
For all the beginning of time until where we are now.
Amen. Yeah. Thank you.